सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
We are going to continue our conversation with Hassan Khawar, a young intellectual who's writing a lot in newspapers, working a lot as a development practitioner with donors, used to be a civil servant, knows a lot about the civil service. Let's continue our conversation. We'll pick up where I was asking him about the fact that the civil service in the past used to do research. What does it do now? All you have to do is to go to the India Office Library and you see something which always amazes me and still amazes me, that the role of the civil service in those days was really that of a researcher. I mean, they wrote these gazetteers, which were solid research documents. They were all capable of winning a PhD based on those documents, right? And so, a large part of the civil service work, especially the younger days, was seriously developing this data for the government. With the result that even today, we know the sociology and the history and many things about our country through those gazetteers. Right?
Absolutely.
Now, if that is true, what does our civil servant do today? Why is he not writing gazetteers? Why is he not? So explain to me, when you were a civil servant, what was your job?
Okay. I think that's a very interesting question, Lok Sahab. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the role of a deputy commissioner, traditionally, mm-hmm. he had three primary roles. Mm-hmm. One was to be the district collector. Mm-hmm. The second was to be a district magistrate.
Collector means collector of revenues. Collector of revenues, right?
Of land revenue. Okay. Yes, collector of land revenue. Mm-hmm. The second was being of a district magistrate. Mm-hmm. And the third one mm-hmm. was of the face of the state in the district. Mm-hmm. And if there was a dysfunctional local government also to take over that role, which I don't subscribe to, but that was another role. Mm-hmm. Now, look at the present scenario. Mm-hmm. Number one, land revenue mm-hmm. no more mm-hmm. is a major source of revenue. Mm-hmm. It's now, its actual utility is to provide land records. Mm-hmm. And with Punjab, in Punjab, for example, the Punjab Land Record Authority has come up. Mm-hmm. So that function has considerably been diluted. Mm-hmm. So that's one. Mm-hmm. The second one was being of a district magistrate mm-hmm. in 1996 and then 2001. Mm-hmm. That function went away as well. So there is no law and order dimension to the role of a deputy commissioner. Okay. When the system was replaced by the concept of a district coordination officer mm-hmm. in 2001, mm-hmm. that was of a chief executive of a district mm-hmm. reporting to a political representative mm-hmm. where all the functions of the government or most of them were devolved mm-hmm. at the level of the district. Mm-hmm. Now, we have done away with that system as well. Mm. And now the role of a deputy commissioner, which has come back, has become totally unclear. So, for example, if you look at the, I forgot the exact title, the Civil Administration Act or something like that in Punjab, actually talks about a deputy commissioner who will have anything that is delegated to him by the chief executive of the provinces. And then he has the powers to inquire and investigate any function, but he did not have any original jurisdiction. And that's a problem. And then you involve him in district health authorities and district education authorities, which should
be basically he's become his master's voice rather than having clear functions determined by the law given to him. Right?
Yes, and they change a little bit from province to province, but in Punjab, absolutely.
Okay, now tell me another thing that I keep asking civil servants, even when I go to the staff college, I ask them. Were you ever involved in the policy process?
If you are asking me individually,
left it a long time ago when you were too junior. But tell me, describe to me, do you know what the policy process is in the government?
Yeah, it can really vary. Okay. But generally, I have never seen a methodical, uniform process to formulate a policy being adopted anywhere. Mm-hmm. It could vary from a very strong minister mm-hmm. with a very strong vision mm-hmm. to a place where the minister is interested in only a few things and the policy space is open mm-hmm. and a strong civil servant kind of gets into that space and puts in place a policy, or it could be a place where neither the minister nor the secretary is interested in policy, and there is a policy vacuum.
So,
and there are a lot of, yes, so let's there are a number of sectors where there are no policies.
Okay. Let's take the example that's close to everybody's heart. Education. Imran has been talking about education, how KPK improved it. Shahbaz has been saying he improved education in Punjab. So do we have an education policy in place, federal level, provincial level? If we do, how was it formulated? Do you have any idea?
I'm not absolutely sure whether there is a formal policy document in Punjab or KP. I don't recall that, but there was a mechanism in place. So a policy could be a stated formal document, or a policy could be an agreed vision. Okay. And I think in both KP and Punjab, there was a policy of sorts where there was an agreed vision in terms of what needs to be done. And much of the policy in action that you see in these two provinces was very similar and was based on developing education roadmaps and tracking a handful of indicators. And both the provinces actually adopt the deliverology model introduced by Michael Barber. Now, people have criticism on that model, and some people agree to that, some people do not subscribe to that. But in effect, there was this similar policy of sorts in place in both provinces.
So what I get from this is very interesting, and I think we should think about it a little. You're saying, despite all this talk about education, and everybody seems to, I mean, education seems to have become a new mantra. You can't disagree with education. Everybody loves education, and we must educate everybody. And Article 25A is written on our hearts. So fair enough. But despite all this rhetoric, you don't know, and neither do I, know of any education policy document anywhere in the government. One. Two, we also don't know who made the policy. You said Michael Barber or Alif Alan or whoever, the donors. So basically donors are making policies. So what is the civil service doing? Are they not even researching education? They're not even monitoring education. They're not even putting out a document in education. Is that correct?
Lakshad, in particular, I know of a few bright civil servants, for example.
Fair enough. So do
working
I.
In the
I know
education
many of
space.
Many of them are very
yes.
bright. I agree. They come through an exam. Who, they must be bright. Huh?
Yes. And what I observed was that they were on the same page when the policy was being implemented. Whether they had a say when the policy was being thought out or when it was being formulated, I cannot say, and I would doubt that. With as strong a chief minister as Shehbaz Sharif there, with someone as tall a personality as Michael Barber in the international circles, I would think that bureaucracy had a very little say initially when the plan was being hashed out. So in a way, I'm confirming to what you are saying. But then, of course, they were part of the process of implementation.
So do you agree with this? Do you think this is a good system? Or should there have been a proper policy on the record, on the website, that you and I could study, read, comment on? And there should be consistent monitoring by the civil service, which means that they should be putting out quarterly documents telling us how the policy is being implemented, where it is being implemented. Because right now, from what I hear from you, and I keep talking to lots of people doing this podcast, every time I do this podcast, I hear that there is no policy process. That everything is done at the whim of either the Prime Minister or some donor came in, Michael Barber came in, said this, or somebody came in and said this. Is that how we should run the country? I'm worried.
I'm worried too. So in some cases, when you do these things, of course, not everything is bad, and they do end up delivering some results. For example, all the system in Punjab reportedly reduced teacher absenteeism, reduced the number of out-of-school children. So I'm not saying it did not deliver. But as a general rule, this system should not happen like this. There has to be more transparency to the system. And what you refer to, there has to be much more transparency in terms of disclosing to the public what's happening. As you said, releasing quarterly reports. And talking to the public, this is what we are investing, and this is what it is delivering. Mm. So it has to be much more broad-based, and it has to be much more consultative and much more transparent. Mm. I totally agree with you.
Now, I was looking at the UK system, for example. UK had a major education, at least research reform recently, and I was just I was studying it for something that I was doing myself, and I began to look at what's happened in UK. And it's very interesting. UK set up a commission in 28 or something like that. 2011, a major report was issued, right? And that report was issued, it was a commission. The commission put up a very serious reform, right? And they put up a very serious reform that was talked about and discussed. I'm just trying to get the name of the reform, the committee, I forget now. And that, after much discussion, a white paper was issued, right? And after that, a law was passed in 2013, 14, something like that, right? Now, that's the way our parent civil service works. There is a proper commission. Based on the commission, the civil service makes a white paper. The white paper is put out. Everybody debates the white paper. Even the Royal Society had a comment on it, right? And then they passed a law to make the change. Why don't we do that?
That's a million-dollar question.
Right?
I asked the same question. Absolutely.
If I remember right, and you can correct me on that, although you're younger, you might not remember, but I do remember. When I was young, there used to be serious commission reports in Pakistan. For example, the Sharif Commission report on education is still talked about. The Munir Commission report on civil service reform is still talked about. I think it was Munir Commission, if I'm not wrong. And then, there was a Cornelius report too, right? Maybe it was a Cornelius report that I'm confusing with. There was the Ayub Khan report on cooperative society. There was a Masood Commission report on the Haris. There was a lot of reports that civil service actually used to form a commission and write, right? Those reports were taken seriously. Then I remember when I was young, there were even some statistics and reports put out by ministries. All that has stopped. Is that is that part of a good governance? Should it happen or not?
I think it absolutely should happen. Mm-hmm. When you talk about civil service reform, I think the last piece of serious work was done by a National Commission of Government Reforms, I think back in 2008 or something. Ishrat Hussain report. And after that, there was none. And I don't think any part of that was implemented or taken seriously. Although when you look at the report, there might be things you disagree with, but it has done serious work. So I don't think that has been happening. And that's the problem I see. So when initially I said that it is very heartening that people are talking about these things because that has been missing out in the last 10 years. The narrative was shifted from these reforms to infrastructure development and a lot of other things. And I'm very glad that we at least have started to talk about these task forces and these commissions, and some appetite for reform is there now.
But Hassan, part of the problem also is that when we talk about reform, we have got used to thinking of everything. I mean, I remember when I was in the Planning Commission, I made this framework of economic growth, and then I tried to, you know, go to universities and talk about it because I thought that was a good place to get a discussion going. So they would always tell me, oh, that's okay, but who's going to implement it? And my answer was standard. I said, you guys have got used to your servants. You think development is a recipe and some cook should cook it and put it before you while you're playing golf. I think societies don't work that ways. Development is a process in which all of us have to work very hard. It's not about somebody writing something and you just running around with it like a recipe. No, we all have to work very hard to make it happen. So I think one thing is that we all ourselves have forgotten. What role should universities play in this? What role should think tanks play in this? I mean, this is like we were talking about earlier, and this is a big thing that's happened now, that they've set up an economic advisory committee. I don't know what you think about it. I'm totally opposed to it. I think we should have no economic advisory committee. Talk is cheap. And people who come in and into a room and talk with no skin in the game, I don't think they're worth listening to. Right? So in a sense, the civil service has to play the role of the policy formulation and policy developer before it can implement it. If you can get outside consultants to come and tell the civil servants what to do, I don't think the civil servants will be able to do it. Would you agree?
Doctor, I was strongly in favor of having an economic advisory council because, yes, talk is cheap, but I think there is no harm in listening to people who have good exposure, who have good brains, who have good credentials. Yes, we are not asking them to run everything, but asking for good advice, in my view, is a good step.
Okay.
Now,
let me tell you my take on that. I was a deputy chairman of the Planning Commission, right?
Yes.
For 3 years, as you know. I keep telling people, I've said this on television, I've said this many times, I was not allowed to make a single presentation to the cabinet. I was not allowed to make a single presentation to the prime minister. I was not allowed to make a single presentation to the president or the chief of army staff or anybody that matters. Yet, we formed these councils which were sitting there and pontificating. Nobody even knows what the deputy chairman is saying. Why should the council be taken seriously then? Right? One. Two, if these guys come and say things, and then of course there are pressure groups too, like Pakistan Business Council. I attended 3 or 4 meetings. The Pakistan Business Council was making a presentation to all the powerful people, and I'm sitting there silently watching. Right? If you're going to run a government like that, then hey, my view was, why should I even listen? Am I wrong?
No, you are absolutely correct. That's not going to work. So anyone who is forming any sort of advisory forum should keep the mandate of that forum limited to his mandate. So if, for example, you are forming a National Economic Advisory Council, if the Prime Minister takes interest in that, if the Prime Minister attends those meetings, which at some point he said that he was going to, then I think it's a good step. If you are Deputy Chairman of Planning Commission, and let's say that you are interested with the task of developing an economic growth strategy and to form an advisory council to develop that strategy, I think that's fair. Once you have the strategy, the strategy implementation goes way beyond the scope of the Planning Commission, and the Prime Minister and the Cabinet has to agree.
The problem is that when I made that strategy, for example, take the plan, for example, or take anything, the Economic Advisory Council people, when they come in and I ask them, they said, hey, we don't need to read your plan. We don't even like it. Right? We don't even want to read it. Yes, right? So now we've got a problem. You've got the government preparing something. The advisory people are coming in saying, I don't want to listen. I think we've got a chaotic system where everything goes overboard. What I'm getting to, and let me make that point carefully and then you can comment on it. I think the policy has to emanate from within the government. Outsiders can comment, discuss, understand, yes, fully agreed. But that is not limited to the Economic Advisory Committee. That is that we should also engage universities in that. We should engage think tanks in that. We should engage civil society in that. Everybody must be commenting the government work. And that can only happen if the civil service, because it's ultimately it's a civil service. The civil service, the government can, and you know, the prime minister or whoever doesn't have the time. He's not going to write the report. He's going to give directions. Somebody has to write the report. I still believe that work happens when somebody writes a report, right? And that report has to be made public and widely discussed. Then the Economic Advisory Committee can comment on the report. Agreed. But this business of sitting there and pontificating with nothing, civil service not offering anything, I think leads to a very chaotic government which can't work then. Would you agree with me?
Totally. So I would not want to think or suggest that any advisory council should be taken as a board of doctors where a patient would come with his illness and the board is going to prescribe a medication.
Or it should not be take like what you said earlier, that Michael Barber came and made our education policy. Right?
In a way, yes.
Okay. So then, if I'm Secretary of Education or if I'm in charge, why should I take it seriously?
The people who were there took it seriously because the Chief Minister took the advice seriously.
So basically what you're saying is it's a danda, it's the stick that drove them.
Yes. Okay. And then, of course, they hired good civil servants. Some of them were genuinely interested, but the direction was coming from the top. So the roadmap review was done every quarter, which was jointly chaired by the chief minister and Michael Barber. And that created a lot of traction. So whatever the government wanted to do did happen. We may question some of that, that some of that was not needed or we could do it better, but some of that worked. And I think because the reform ownership was coming directly from the chief minister, doesn't matter if it was prescribed by someone else, it was successful in some ways when it was implemented. But the chief executive was on board, right? Whether he should take that advice or not, and the way that advice should come may differ. I totally agree with you. But more important than that is that whatever the recipe for success is or whatever the medication is, the ownership has to be given by the top man. And if it's not there, no matter how good an advice is, it's not going to work.
Let me take you in another direction, which is also important. Chief Minister Shahbaz Sharif wanted the metro, and the civil service delivered the metro. I perfectly agree with you. The civil service delivered the metro. But I differ slightly. I think the metro should not have been built. And I think if the civil service had done its work properly, the metro would never have been built. Like you remember, Khaja Asif at one point said that if the planning commission was around in Shah Jahan's time, the Taj Mahal would not have been built. And I actually wrote an article against that, saying that, hey, Khaja Sahib, you're absolutely right. But your reasoning is all wrong. The Taj Mahal should never have been built. And the planning commission would have been right if it stopped the Taj Mahal. I think the metro is a Taj Mahal, and the civil service should have stopped it if it had done its work right. Would you agree with me?
Dr. Saab, partially, yes. Mm-hmm. So I do not agree with the rationale for building an orange line. Mm-hmm. I personally think that building a 200 billion rupee metro line in one city on one route is a crime against federation, where you have districts like Khuzdar and Rajanpur and Muzaffargarh, where people do not even have access to drinking water, and where half of our children are stunted.
You put it very
so
well.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
But what I'm going to say is that it depends on my role. If as a civil servant, my role is to be a project director for Orange Line, and if I'm interested in that task, I should not question the rationality.
Absolutely.
My role is to implement, and I should implement, because if I start questioning, then there is going to be no discipline.
Fair point.
Now, what you are referring to is another issue, and the issue relates to the efficacy or effectiveness of our institutions. If Provincial Development Working Party and Central Development Working Party, which are the right fora for any project appraisal, would work effectively, of course, they should not have approved. They should have looked at the resource distribution. They should have looked at the technical aspects, the value for money, the return on investment, and they should have raised due objections. What I came to know that some of the members of the fora did raise objections. The objections are probably already there, especially in case of Islamabad Metro on files, but the approvals were given. And that's why I say that civil service is not a strong institution. It's a weak institution with some strong individuals who may change from time to time or a regime to regime.
Thank you, Hassan, for enlightening us on the role of the civil service, the lack of research, the weak service, the fact that individuals dominate it. Is that what we want? I don't think so. A modern civil service needs something very, very different. We will talk about it next time.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।